Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Welcome to another edition of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I am Jason Barrett. It's great to have you aboard for another week of sports radio conversations. A reminder that if you're not already a subscriber on iTunes, please take a moment to change that. While you're there, if you'd be so kind to leave a review, it's greatly appreciated. On today's episode, I spent time in Las Vegas recently sitting down for a lengthy conversation with Mitch Moss of VSiN, the Vegas Stats and Information Network. We were stationed right outside the network studios inside the South Point Casino at 8:30 in the morning. I had to play with the levels a little bit to offset some of the background noise from the slot machines, and I think it sounds all right, but if anything appears off when you're listening, please send me an email, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. The reason I wanted to visit with Mitch is because he spent most of his career in local radio, specifically Las Vegas, prior to making the jump to focus on sports betting content on a national platform. I thought it'd be interesting to educate you on his radio travels and take a deeper look at how he operates in a space which is still niche, but rapidly growing and creating great industry interest. In fact, Mike Francesa this week announced on his WFAN Return show that VSiN had made him an offer to join them. I'm sure he won't be the last great talent the network makes a run at. For those of you in the radio business who are looking for a gig, I've posted a few openings on the website, sportsradiopd.com. I'm helping one great company in a strong sports market with their search for a new general sales manager. I've also got another situation which I'm going to be assisting with that involves the content side of the business, and I invite you to reach out and make sure I'm aware of your name, experience, and long-term goals. I actually have a number of thoughts on this subject that I want to expand on, so without wasting time, I'm going to dive into it as part of this week's BSM 180.
You have 3 minutes, and you better make it good.
If there's an area of our business that concerns me, it's the way we develop future program directors. I've seen many situations where executives fall in love with a resume, big market experience, or popular internal candidate, rather than examining an individual's strategy, vision, and ability to run a business and reach a room. I take pride in the fact that I've developed multiple PDs, APDs, and executive producers. I used to tell Jeremiah Crow, if you don't want my chair, that's a problem. I looked at it like this. If the day came where I wasn't doing my job and the station could get better and save money by dropping me for the APD, then that's on me for not proving my worth. But there could also be a day where I leave for a new city, move into corporate, or start my own business as I did 3 years ago. And when that day comes, I need the person behind me to be ready to step up. When I started programming stations, there was no Windows for Dummies to learn how to run a sports radio station. I learned quickly that most folks don't know what a great programmer does. Few asked about my ability to write imaging or create buzzworthy promotions. They knew little about my ability to negotiate, recruit, or coach people. They just trusted the resume and references and formed an opinion off my personality and hoped their instincts were right. There's much more to programming than filling out work schedules, writing promos, sending ratings emails, and attending sales meetings. I went through 3 situations without much help until my last 2 employers gave me a consultant. Rick Scott, whose website I read for years and who I sought out numerous times for career advice, became a mentor and friend. We spent 6 years working together in St. Louis and San Francisco, and when I moved into this space nearly 3 years ago, it's because I believed in the value of outside mentorship. I think PDs and GMs can do much more to prepare their people for advancement opportunities, but individuals have to help themselves too. Who are you seeking out to learn from? What do you do when the PD doesn't make time to help you? Are you calling other PDs besides the one in your building just to hear a different perspective? Have you asked your company to let you spend a day or two in another one of their buildings to see how they operate? If you want to be a program director, it's highly unlikely that you'll land a gig by replying to a job posting. Most times, these jobs are worked on in advance before a hiring manager even looks at the stack of applications on their desk. Just last week, I posted a listing encouraging folks to reach out who have an interest in running radio stations. Many want better pay and bigger responsibilities, but they don't always think about what they're doing in the interim to prepare themselves for that next situation. Nobody is going to make you invest in your development. If you don't take the steps yourself to do so, you may never escape that stack of paperwork that's sitting on the general manager's desk. Do you agree? Disagree? Either way, I welcome the feedback. Pass it along on Twitter at SportsRadioPD, or you could do so by email, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. That brings us to this week's interview, and my special guest is Mitch Moss, currently one half of the VSiN morning show Follow the Money, which he hosts alongside Paulie Howard. We spent over 45 minutes diving into Mitch's career stops, VSiN's progress, the future of sports betting, working with Brent Musburger, and more. Rather than extending the setup any further, I'm just going to dive into it right now. 3, 2, 1. I know you since we worked together in San Francisco. I've seen you out here in Las Vegas for a while. You know what I don't know? How you got your radio start. So where did it begin?
In high school, small town in Wisconsin. We had like a career day when I was a sophomore, and that was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Population there, about 50,000, and a bunch of schools were there. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, you know, once I graduated high school. But I knew I wanted to get in sports somehow. And I love the idea of, you know, just growing up and listening to, you know, play-by-play guys on the radio and then eventually getting, you know, listening to sports talk or whatever. I'm like, yeah, radio would be awesome. And I saw this this small stand. Nobody was going up to it. It was called the Madison Media Institute. And I said, wow, there's actually a broadcasting school in Madison, Wisconsin. I had no idea that it even existed. So I started to talk to the people. I got all of the brochures and everything like that. And then eventually, when I started to look into it a little bit more seriously, I got down to brass tacks, contacted them, and I'm like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I'm going to see what this is like. Went down there, took a tour of it, loved it, said this is exactly where I want to go to school and eventually see if this can stick and get involved in radio and broadcasting somehow. It was a radio TV school. The TV portion, I'll be quite frank, was not very good. Okay. In fact, they kind of stopped teaching it midway through, and it was only based on radio then. And it kind of just took off from there. And I did... Like, I learned from, you know, some people that I listened to back then at 18, 19 years old, do as many things as humanly possible. So whether that was high school girls volleyball at the time, go and do that kind of event. Go to take stats at a Little League baseball game, whatever it was. I did as many things as possible. And then back where I'm from, there was an opening to do some play-by-play and to do some top 40 music, believe it or not. So I applied for that, and I got the gig, and I moved back to where I'm originally from, and that's where I got my start, I guess, working.
So top 40 DJ.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Could you hit the post?
I did, actually. Do you remember Better Than Ezra?
Yeah.
Awaha, that song. I remember hitting the post on that when I was like 20 years old, and by the way, I had a different name.
Who were you?
It was Ryan Mitchell was the name.
That's a total top 40 name.
Of course, right. So then I had the whole fake voice and everything like that, too. So that was fun for, you know, 3-4 months, whatever it was. But then I told them, I'm like, listen, I want to focus on play-by-play and doing as many events as I possibly could, and they let me do that.
There's so much to be learned and enjoyed. Like, when you build a career in this business and you start on the smaller level, you learn so much. Like, I was doing play-by-play. I got put out one time to do a game. I was told it was going to be a high school game. I get there. It's not a high school game. It's a Little League game.
Sure.
But it's a Little League game with no balls, no strikes, no outs, and it's for the Special Olympics.
Set up jobs, yeah.
This is a day where you don't have a cell phone, and I'm trying on a payphone to call my boss going, how am I going to do 3 hours of broadcasting with no balls, no strikes, no outs? This is a disaster. And of course, he's not answering the phone on purpose because it was one of those welcome to radio moments. And I'm over there, you know, trying to turn this thing into a real event. My partner's looking at me going, what are we doing here? But it was a great learning lesson because although at the time I wanted to strangle my boss, I'm thinking to myself, right now I have 3 hours to figure out how to entertain an audience, and this is never going to happen on a major market station. But in those moments, you learn so much. Like, what was your small market moment that you look back on and go, geez,
I wasn't ready.
Well, I mean, some of the spots where you had to broadcast from, right? And then, like, I'm no engineer, but in a small market like that, you're not going to have an engineer.
Right.
So you're going to be basically, and sometimes you're not going to have a color guy. So it's going to be you and you only. And you got to learn how to make it work if a telephone line's not working. And all of a sudden you're looking and you have 30 minutes to broadcast and you're like, you know what your boss is going to be like, right?
Right?
And I actually came up with a great guy named Mike Sullivan. Awesome. He's so loyal and he wanted to do Eau Claire sports for the rest of his life. Like, he could have gotten like an NHL job, I think, at some point. I mean, he was so good, but he's also hardcore and he's a stickler. Like, Mitch, if you don't get this taken care of, like, I'm not going to be happy. And I totally got it. But that came across like, I got to make Mike happy, right?
Right.
But if this plugin's not working, what am I? I'm not an electrician. What do I do? How do I make this work? And then you'd broadcast on a windy night on the top of like a roof somewhere where papers are flying all over the place. Or you might have set up a table on the third base line.
Or you're doing play-by-play in the stands as people are heckling you.
Yeah, and they're going to be, who knows, cursing right behind you, something like that. So and back there where the weather might be completely crazy. I mean, all that stuff kind of happened, like stuff that you would just, I mean, it's high school stuff, but you know what? That's what happens.
So how did you wind up making the transition from Eau Claire, Wisconsin to Las Vegas, Nevada? That's a complete shift.
I will tell you how, I will fully admit, a lot of times it's not what you know, it's who you know. First off, I came out here in 1998 on a whim. My buddy was in the military. And I stayed here for like 12 days, but we also took a tour of the whole southwestern part of the U.S. We went to L.A. and San Diego and Mexico and like Flagstaff and Phoenix. And halfway through the trip, I'm like, I'm 21 years old. There's no doubt in my mind I'm going to live in Las Vegas or somewhere in the southwest at some point. I loved it from the second I basically landed. Then fast forward a couple of years, a guy that we each know in the business, John Hansen, he never wanted to visit Las Vegas. I'm like, I was working with him at the time in Eau Claire. And I said, man, you have a chance to go to Las Vegas. His friends lived out here. I'm like, trust me on this. You're going to love Las Vegas. Well, he came out here and he thought the same exact thing. He's like, I don't care. I'm moving to Las Vegas. I love it. He did. He eventually got a job at Lotus Broadcasting out here as the PD. And he called me. He's like, I always told you, like, if we can make it happen, like, I'm going to bring you along and I'll create a job or whatever if they're going to allow me to do this. And he called me a couple of months later and he said, they need a producer. He's like, I want you to come out here. And so I fully owe that to John Hansen. Again, not knowing not what I knew, but who I knew. He is responsible for allowing me to come out here and get a job full-time as a producer at the time of Lotus Broadcasting.
So you join John. You're working for Lotus at the time. They've been around for a couple decades now, right? So what were those early days doing local sports radio in Las Vegas like?
Oh, man, compared to today. I mean, JB, going back to 2001, when we first got here, like, the phone would ring on the air, the setup was. And the studio was so small, like, four of us would be sitting around like this. We're at a booth right now here at this casino, but we'd be, like, snug sitting next to each other, and we couldn't figure out a way to turn the phone off. So when we take callers, you'd hear, bring, bring, like, you're like, what? What is this nonsense? I mean, the thought of actually having pro teams in Las Vegas, we laughed at it. And now here we are, like, I came out here in 2001, 17 years later. We always said, like, the idea of getting a major league team, and as the years went on, this was 2005, and then 2008, 2010, whatever, like, we're 5 years away from being 5 years away from even having a conversation. Well, now look it. I can't even believe that we're here today talking about, you know, the Golden Knights are such a great story and the Raiders are coming to town. I mean, a completely different world.
So when you started in local radio here in Las Vegas, what were you guys talking about? Was it all sports betting? Because, I mean, obviously that's grown, but also, who were the shows on your station at that time?
Oh, man. The show that I came out to produce right away was called The Clubhouse with Seat Williams and Dave Koken were on the show on a daily basis. Frank Harnish was on it once in a while. He's still over at Lotus. So is Dave. And they've been mainstays. They've been there for a long time. And then they just created shows beyond that. John actually started to do a show with The Sports Dude. And then he started to do a show with Dave Koken, and then it kind of expanded from that. Al Bernstein came on board, the legendary boxing commentator. He did a show. I produced that show with him for around 3 years, and that was on the ESPN affiliate. And then it just started to grow a little bit more. They always had the ESPN affiliate, and back then it was, with Papa Joe on Sporting News Radio, I believe, at the time. And they've had a couple of sports stations, but it's gotten a lot bigger, and they now have, I think, three stations here in town. I mean, it wasn't like a major market where it would have, you know, the morning show is going to be on from 6 to 10, and then who's going to be on middays, and then it's going to be afternoon drive. It was one local show for like 2 hours every day from noon to 2, and that was about it. and it was running Rebel basketball, the NFL, and at the time, believe it or not, XFL was huge here in town. I moved out here, that league kicked off with Vince McMahon, the fireworks and everything like that. So that was my introduction to Las Vegas. And
so how did you wind up, I mean, I'm guessing just by being in the right place at the right time. You produce, get to know people, eventually you earn your opportunities on the air. When did you discover you wanted to become a host?
When I was on with Al quite a bit and I was producing a show, I would talk with him quite a bit on the air. And then so once we learned that he was going to focus more on boxing and stuff like that, they talked to me about doing the show for 2 hours every single day to replace Al, and they were going to move things around to have a whole new lineup and everything like that. And I thought, yeah, absolutely, why not? Give this a shot. There's an opening here. I got to take it right now. I mean, if they're going to say basically again, it's your chance, Mitch. Do you want it or no? I mean, they left it up to me, and I said, yeah, absolutely. So that started for me to do 2 hours every single day, and then as it kind of escalated and John left and I took over for him as the PD, it kind of morphed again where I eventually changed the shows, and so I didn't have to do a PD. I wasn't the PD and doing a show by myself every single day. So I joined and I kind of combined my show with Seat Williams and Paulie Howard at the time.
What made you decide I want to get into management at that point?
I didn't know if I wanted to or not. Again, it was one of those things where they asked me and I was like, I guess. I was a little slow to come around to that idea because I'll be quite honest. I mean, like I never, looking back at my early years, I never got into radio with the idea of I want to be a PD, I want to manage people. I never did. But I also thought to myself, kind of growing up with that mentality of I want to know as much as about radio as possible. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I want to have that on my resume to where I've done everything. And so I thought it'd be a great opportunity again. And if I didn't take it then, when would I have that chance to do it ever again?
What was the hardest part of being a program director when you made that jump?
So when I was the host too, there was trying to find a balance. Well, you know how it is. I mean, how often is the talent at a station going to be genuinely happy? They're never going to complain. That's not going to happen, right? So how would I have a balance of being the program director at the same time of trying to be a player-friendly coach, kind of, if you will, right? Because when the guys would complain about something, I could see their point of view, but also I knew what was going to fly when I had to go and battle management. Like, okay, what's worth really going to battle for when I really want to, like, win the war, so to speak, right? I know what's worth talking about and what's worth discussing. So I had to just, like, if they're unhappy, how do I kind of, like, convey that message to, like, it's going to work on both sides? That was a little difficult, to be quite honest.
So what were the parts of the job that you liked the most, and what were the parts that you dreaded the most?
Dreaded getting a phone call at 10 o'clock at night, we're off the air. I'm not the engineer. I mean, I'll come in, but if there's a major problem, like, I'll try to make it work. But, I mean, it was always something like that. Hey, there's a problem, and Mitch, you're on the air at, I think we're doing noon to 3 at the time. So it was Paulie, Seat, and me. And at 11:15, I'll get a phone call from whatever, buzz from traffic. Hey, spots haven't been playing this morning. What happened? Terrific. So then I have to go back and look, go in and look at the computer. Why are we not going to get money coming in from the spots that didn't play? And meanwhile, I look down and I have to go into the traffic office and then maybe with the operations manager or something. And no, by the way, I'm on the air in 5 minutes and I haven't had a chance to prep the guys at all today. And then as soon as the show is over with, there's an event taking place at something for the Southern Nevada Sports Hall of Fame. We have to have somebody there and I want to go schmooze with the people that are in charge of that. And I got to run over to that. So it's just like that whole thing. There was always, it never went smoothly, put it that way.
Was there any part of it that you liked?
Believe it or not, I like making the schedule. I thought that was cool. Looking ahead to what we're going to come up with. And I like coming up with ideas of how we can try to like balance all this stuff and make it work. I'll be quite honest, I don't think I had enough time to really do what a full-time PD is supposed to do. Sit down, air check, guys, let's kind of focus on this. Let's kick around other good ideas that we like. There was so much other stuff with talking to the GM and talking to the sales manager, and we had a lot of paid programming that I had to deal with, which was a lot of nonsense, to be quite honest. So there was always going to be that headache. I mean, there was a lot to it, to be quite honest.
So how long were you there before you came out to the Bay Area to join me in San Francisco?
A little bit more than 10 years.
Okay, so you do a decade there. It's, I think it was 2011, right? You and I met and we talked about you coming on board to the game because we launched in August. I think we met like around October. Yeah. We were a few months in and then eventually you took the plunge. And when you came out to the Bay Area, you joined me as a producer working with John Lund and Greg Papa. Why at that point in your life were you looking to get away from the microphone, get away from programming, and go into producing a show in a top five market?
Well, I never was about, hey, I have to be on the air and I got to be a superstar and anything like that. I was willing to, again, pretty much do whatever it would take, and I like to be challenged as well, and I like the idea. And there's a long backstory to the San Francisco thing as well. My wife, when I met her, worked in media. She was a TV anchor / reporter. So right around the time that we got married, she had a chance to go to Sacramento, and then we were splitting our time. And then she worked her way into getting a job at KTVU, the Fox affiliate, in San Francisco. And that's when you and I kind of had the discussion about, I mean, between my wife and I was like, okay, we're not going to do this commute the whole time. So what's going to happen? Like, are you going to come back to Las Vegas? Or am I going to actually, like, find a job in San Francisco if I can in radio and make that move? So then, you know, I found out, I was Googling some stuff, whatever, found out that there was an opening where you were at the game in San Francisco. And I'm like, wow, what is this? And so I took a shot with that. We got to talking, and when she's from the Bay Area originally. So we had visited San Francisco and Napa and, you know, Lake Tahoe. That's not really the Bay Area, but that whole area many times. And I'm like, oh, my God, who doesn't love the Bay Area? It's unbelievable.
It is. I mean, I'm a New York guy, so I'll always, you know, defer to where I'm from. But that's the best place I've ever lived.
Yep. It wasn't easy because at the time, like, our ratings were awesome here. I mean, Lon Kruger just left to take the UNL, the Oklahoma job. We had that going. I mean, there were, like, many, many huge stories taking off. And, like, our national shows, like, Colin Coward was our morning show at the time. His ratings were through the roof. And our local shows were, the ratings were unbelievable. So it was not an easy call. I mean, I'm like, really? And at the time, I think I'd been the PD for, like, 3 or 4 years. And that was kind of, I was definitely prideful over that. You know, a lot to be proud about. And so I thought our shows were really good, and I think we were starting to, like, take off, too, with the sales staff and stuff like that, and trying to make a mark here in Las Vegas. So it wasn't easy if I didn't take that shot to maybe move to San Francisco. Eventually, when you offered me the job, again, I'm like, if I don't take that, then what, am I going to get divorced? My wife, she doesn't want to move back to Las Vegas at the time. I mean, we just got married, like, a year and a half before that. Something I wanted to do, though.
Okay.
Andrew Luck was a huge story at the time. And so I'm talking to you in London. I'm like, okay, well, we can talk about Stanford football and Luck. And you guys look at me, you're like, college football? What? You don't talk college football? I'm like, wow. So I was blown away at that, by the way. So he was a bigger story nationally than he was locally. And so, and I'm like, yeah, you know what? That makes sense because, I mean, what, 6 major teams here, 6 pro teams? And it's like a total game changer.
The issue there is, which of these teams should you be talking at this time? It's not, there's so much content to work with. It's just trying to pick out, should we do 80% Giants and 20% football or 80% football and 20% baseball? I mean, but you're never working with a shortage of content. You always have something to talk about.
First of all, the San Jose Sharks, the hockey team, they were always like making deep runs. They do almost every single year, right? But when I was there, they were really good. We're like, how much do we talk about the Sharks? I mean, it's the NHL we're talking about here. And we're talking now, we have the Niners were really good because they had Harbaugh and they had an awesome roster. And the Giants were winning World Series, you know, and the A's that year when they won the West.
And then Mark Jackson came to the Bay, and he was the Warriors are in a resurgence. The Monte Ellis trade happens. You're like, man, there's so much going on here.
On a daily basis, I mean, you did not know which – forget about talking anything outside of the local market there because it was the 6 teams, and that's going to be it.
The one part of it that was a pain in the ass, as great as it was for the Bay Area fan, you go from a competitive standpoint, our competitor – has all of these damn teams.
Yeah, right?
Why can't they all suck right now?
Yeah, right. And for years they did. Right. The Warriors were a laughingstock for like 40 years, and all of a sudden they got Steph Curry and they took off and, you know, other things like that.
I just get there. I'm like, all right, the Giants just finally won a World Series. Mark Jackson has the Warriors brand new. Jim Harbaugh is like the best coach the Niners have had in 20 years.
Yep.
And it's all happening on our competitor's station. And I'm sitting here with the freaking A's and the Raiders at the time, not hot. But then the A's get hot in that September, which was good. You know, and at that point, you can't control that. What you look for is, hey, if people are into the Giants, Niners, and Warriors, okay, they're going to have the games. We got to talk better about it.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, the guy going to work, he may listen to the game there, but he's going to look for content to listen to on 2 stations. We were on FM, which helped. And you just hope that your talent's doing a good job talking about the right topics.
No question. And I will say this, too. I mean, knowing what I know now, wow, the Bay Area is a wildly underrated sports market. People will bring up New York and Boston and Philly and Chicago and maybe LA. I mean, I could not believe how popular the Giants are in the Bay Area. It was Halloween Day. when they won the World Series, and you were like, guys, go enjoy the parade. And we went down there, and what, they have like 1.6 or 1.8 million people in downtown San Francisco, and they sold out every single game, and the buzz there in that city, it was just, it was remarkable. I'll never forget that.
It was eye-opening because, as you mentioned, like, I always would hear Philadelphia, Boston, Detroit, New York, Chicago, those are the red-hot markets. That's where you want to be. And, you know, I knew about KBR. Okay, that's the WFAN of the West Coast. And they got the big signal that goes from Mexico to Canada. I remember a reporter one time when we launched the game, he said to me, so what are you going to do about the fact that KBR goes from Mexico to Canada? I said, well, when they start measuring ratings in Mexico or Canada, I'll turn in my resignation. Until then, I'm going to focus on the Bay Area. And thank God for that, because I can't control that. They're in three freaking countries at that point.
Get them here in Las Vegas. I can listen to Giants games at night here in Las Vegas.
I'm like, listen, I'm not going to pretend that they don't have a powerful signal. They do. But I also know that regardless of your signal, if your content isn't great, it's just heard more. That's all. So you got to focus on content. And, you know, we had a long-term plan, not just a get on the air. It's just like whenever I see a new show, you see this with Get Up, when Bayless went to FS1. 3 days in, it's dead.
It sucks.
And I'm like, nobody works that way. These things take time. If something's really bad, 12 to 24 months in, you're going to change it. But it's just like an expansion football team where, like, the Golden Knights right now are a great story. You're seeing it every day. They're way ahead of the curve. But normally, you're bad the first year. You get a little better year two. Year three, you're contending for the playoffs. Year four, you should be battling for a championship. In radio, it's the same thing. Like, you know, you got to go into these jobs, 3 to 5 year mentality, going, hey, we're putting a new station on. It's going to take time. It's going to take a few changes to people. You know, we were there. Eric Davis gets a job with the NFL Network. Tierney gets a job at CBS. That's part of a growth of a radio station. But the market, the appetite for the content, the passion for sports there was through the roof.
Oh, sure.
And you look at some of the Giants games, how well they rate. We're looking at World Series games. They're doing a 55 share.
It's amazing.
I'm literally telling our boss at the time. He's like, what do you recommend we do? I said, turn the power off at night and let's save the electricity bills. What do you think I'm going to tell you? There's 90 radio stations battling for a 40 share because they've got 6 out of 10 people listening. Tip of the cap.
Yep.
You got the right play-by-play deal. What are you supposed to do?
Exactly right. It's astonishing.
Just go, we'll get back at it tomorrow at 6 a.m. We're going to save a lot of money tonight.
And you'll battle. And again, like going to war like you did, saying with our local shows, we're going to create better content. And you got to be happy with what happened up there, obviously, because eventually things came around for the game, right? And I mean, it paid off.
I mean, when we started the station, we talked about, hey, the goal is to be in the top five. Within 4 years, we need to be in the top five. 4 years later, we were third and fourth in back-to-back books. I said, guys, we can't be better than this. I'm being honest. I would love to beat the competition, but they got the Niners, they got the Giants, they got the Warriors, they got a 25-year head start. They're going to beat us right now. But if we're in third and they're in first, we're both going to make a lot of money. Now, eventually, after I left, they got the Warriors, and that changes the game because now you have 6 months out of the year where you legitimately can beat them because now you have a cum advantage that you didn't have before. And the Warriors just happen to turn into the greatest basketball team, you know, the last 3 years. That definitely helps. But at that point, we had been doing a great job with building a good radio station. You worked on a great show. John London, Greg Papa, those guys were one of the few shows on the station to beat KNBR for a while.
Yeah, they were awesome. Yep.
Take me through what you learned working with each of those guys, because they're both extremely talented, but both very different.
Oh, they absolutely are. I will say that, boy, Lund is so prepared. I mean, it's sick. And I learned stuff also, not only from Lund, but also from like Whitey Gleason with the Rise guys. Those guys were so prepared. And Lund especially, too, because, he, you know, at the time it was the wheelhouse. So it was Papa occasionally, but also other guys would float in. And to see, like, everything was, like, detailed for every segment. It was almost all timed out, too. Like, he knew exactly what kind of audio he wanted to play here. And also it was like, so I'm producing a show, and he would bounce stuff off of me. But I think he kind of knew, like, on his own where he wanted to take everything, right? I was there as kind of a soundboard, if you will. And I try to help out like producing segments and stuff like that. But just, I mean, the amount of time that he put into every single show was off the charts. It was great. And Papa, I mean, if I could like just try to be as loose as he is, right? Because his sense of humor, the way that they played off each other. And yes, it was like, so Papa, you could throw anything at Papa, right? Any story from the Bay Area. And it's going to be like he knows every single thing about that topic. and he's the master of it, right? And he would be with teams like the Raiders and the Giants because he's a, but it doesn't matter. And he was so sharp with that kind of stuff. But also, just like the rapport that they had and not, you know, I mean, how they would laugh all the time. And I love that, keeping it a little bit loose. Yep. Those two guys really taught me to have a good time.
So what was the biggest challenge of producing the show?
With Lund, not a lot of negatives. With Papa trying to, like, he knows what he wants to do, though. Right, and trying to, like, run an idea past him.
The good ones usually do.
Yeah, right, but trying to run, like, an idea past him or something like that, good luck.
It's not happening, Mitch.
No. It was. In fact, I would text him a couple of times, and it would take, like, until the next day for him to get back to me, and then I'd have this conversation, and I knew what it was going to be like. So I was like, I would say something. I knew it was going to get rejected. I'm like, okay, I'll try to win you over when I see you in person. So that was the most difficult challenge with him.
So you also worked on the morning show. You brought it up, the Rise guys. That was Whitey Gleason, Mark Kreidler, Dan Dibley. Yep. Incredible show, very entertaining guys. Take me through what was different about working with those guys versus the Wheelhouse.
Well, okay, so as much as I like to say that London Papa liked to joke around, I mean, it was a whole different level. And I think that those guys were good at busting balls. Maybe a little bit sometimes it was a little too inside, or maybe I wasn't up on it because I took over for Mason when he left. Right. And I think that, that he kind of knew, because he had a background with those guys, obviously, coming from Sacramento. So I think some of it was maybe inside to me. But they were ultra loose, and their rapport was great as well. I liked how, with the Rise guys, and especially Whitey, we would be communicating, like, in every single break, what we're going to talk about in the next segment, maybe, like, a soundbite that we want to use, but beyond that, too, then the segment beyond that as well. So we were always, like, going in and had a plan, and he would actually, he was willing, like, okay, so at 6:15, do we want to do the Raiders here and what they're going to do in the draft? Or do we want to talk about how Matt Cain last night had 8 strikeouts and he went 7 innings and only gave up 3 hits? Like, what are we doing? What's the angle here? So there's always, like, a communication to try to come up with different angles and different narratives for every story that we wanted to talk about.
He was like a program director of his show. He's a guy that outside of Northern California, a lot of PDs may not know, but they absolutely should. The guy's brilliant. Inside of a show, 16 segments a day. He's got a plan for everything.
Yep.
And he has a backup plan and another backup plan just in case. And to be able to read the guys in the room and how am I going to get this out of Kreidler? What am I going to get out of Dibley? Communicate with the producer. Like, he had a great feel for radio.
I think it was Dibley who called him, like, the best point guard he's ever worked with in radio. And that's exactly what Whitey is. I mean, he's an unbelievable point guard. And he's not a shoot-first point guard either.
He's Steve Nash, not Allen Iverson.
Exactly right.
Sometimes you need to tell Steve Nash to take a shot.
Right.
Because he's so concerned about getting everyone else involved.
Yep.
But he is so good at getting everyone involved.
Oh, Whitey was averaging 10 dimes a game every show. And how he finished the show, the segment,
Jockerty.
How good was that?
It was entertaining
right.
as hell.
Yep. Every single day.
So here, you're in the Bay Area. You spend, what, a year and a half?
A year and a half, 2 years, something like that, yeah.
So under 2 years. Not once, though, did you ask me for an on-air shift.
I did one time.
When?
I'd only been there for a month. Maybe that's why you don't remember it.
I was probably like, produce the show and learn the market, kid, and we'll talk.
Like, worry about it later on.
So after that, though, now you start to, like, build some cachet. Now you're producing the morning show, the midday show. You do know the market. It never came up again. And I only thought about it after you left. Like, wow, you know, like, obviously you went back to Vegas to go back on the air. I'm not saying, I don't know if it would have worked or not, but I never would have hesitated at that point to go, hey, let's put you on 3 hours on Saturday and see what you got. Let's throw you in on a night shift and see what you got. Like, because you have to develop internally, but usually, you know, I'm one of those guys, you earn your stripes and then you get your shot. Once I see a guy inside the door and he's paying dues and I know he's got some talent to do it, yeah, okay, I'll turn him loose. But until I know he's got John London, Greg Pop, and the Rise guys in his corner going, this is our guy, he's on top of it, then I go, all right, well, let's not distract him with the second gig before we worry about the first. Because I've had some producers who produced a show with their eye on the night shift, and I'm like, what about my afternoon guy who you're, like, crapping the bed on today and didn't book a guest, didn't do any production, didn't even give a guy a topic, and now you're worried about 7 to 10. I'm sitting here going, my afternoon guy from 3 to 7 needs some help today.
You know, that was kind of my mentality, though, too. And you always use the saying, stay in your lane, and that's what I was trying to do up there, and I kind of knew what I had to do up there. And maybe if I'd stayed there a little while longer, I would have, you know, knocked on your door again and said, hey, look, I mean, if you need somebody on the weekend or whatever, I'll talk Raiders, talk Niners, whatever. I'd love to do it at some point.
So you go back to Vegas at that point, and you go back to Lotus,
yes,
where you'd been before. You mentioned it was starting to get good, and you left to go to the Bay Area.
Right.
You spend 2 years essentially learning in the Bay Area with some top-notch shows. Then you come back here, and you're 2 years removed. What was it like coming back home to your home radio base, if you will, even though you started in Eau Claire? This is really where you built your name and your business. Yeah. So what was it like then getting back here?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll be quite honest. Going back to making the decision to, you know, maybe come back to Las Vegas, I did not want to leave the Bay Area. I loved it there. And believe it or not, so my wife is from there. She's from Fremont, like I said. She's the one that actually wanted to come back to Las Vegas. She could not do news anymore. Like every single day in the Bay Area, it was like, and this is like in any major market, right? It's, hey, six kids are dead today. Go cover that story in an apartment fire. And then try not to bring that home with you later on that night. And the next day, there's a major car accident or something like that. I mean, it was always just the worst of the worst, right? So I don't blame her for that. I love the Bay Area. I mean, a couple things. I mean, it's so ridiculously expensive. I mean, as you know, the traffic was ungodly. But up there, I thought it was amazing. One of my favorite cities I've ever been to. So it took a while. And then, you know, we're talking about it a little bit more. And then I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go back there. Because the idea of maybe getting a house that's twice as big as the apartment that I was living in for half the cost was slightly appealing.
I was in St. Louis. I had a 3,200-square-foot house. I paid $1,300 a month, which was tremendous.
Yes.
Okay? I take the job in the Bay Area. I send my fiance out to look for a place. I'm like, listen, we need the 3,000 square feet. We were paying $1,300. $2,600, we should be good.
Right.
And she's taking me to all these spots like Hercules, like it doesn't have a kitchen floor. This place in El Cerrito doesn't have a refrigerator. I'm like, you don't know what you're doing. I got this. So I'm like, who's the one guy I would know with ties to St. Louis who lives in the Bay Area? Tony La Russa.
Oh, wow.
He'll know what I'm talking about. Tony, I'm looking for a spot kind of like Creve Coeur, St. Peter's. Where should I be looking? Oh, you got to be in Alamo. I mean, Alamo's where it's at. You got to be in Alamo. I'm like, see, this is it. We got to be in Alamo. So I go and I look, and we find this house, and it is incredible. I'm like, that's the house. $3,800 a month. I'm like feeling like I got kicked in the groin. I'm like, this is going to be rough, but you know what? We're going to make this an adventure. This is the best time of my programming life. I'm doing it, right? And then the first month water bill came. $640.
Get out of here.
I literally went home. I'm like, how much laundry have you been doing? Are you taking five showers a day? You know, the sprinkler system's on outside all the time. What are we doing here? And this was great. She goes, jackass, you're the one who asked a guy who makes $8 million a year where we should live. And you're shocked about a $640 water bill? You think he's ever wrote a check for a water bill? She goes, you didn't think something was up when Jeremy Affeldt and Drew Bennett were in our neighborhood? That guy signed a six-year, $36 million deal with the Rams. You think he's worried about $600? I'm like, oh, my God, why the hell did I move here? About a year and a half later, Walnut Creek knocked that thing down about $1,500 a month. You can't compare this to St. Louis and think you're going to get the same thing because you're going to pay three to four times as much, and it's painful.
Yeah, we lived in a spot in Alameda, which was kind of like right on the bay right there, but that was 1,300 square feet for 26 plus a month or whatever. That said, I didn't really want to leave at first, but then when I did to come back here, I was like, okay, and I learned so much because, I mean, you go from, I mean, you're working with guys that have been all over the map, and Lund was in, my God, he's been all over too in major markets in Portland and Dallas and San Francisco.
I think the only market he hasn't worked is Boise, Idaho.
I think you're right, yeah. So just to like the whole time there, you know, pick and choose stuff that everybody did and working with him and Papa and then Whitey and the Rise guys and everybody else that happened to be at the station at the time and certainly you and Crow, I'm going to remember exactly a lot of this stuff. I'm going to take notes, write this stuff down, and I got 1,000 times better. I mean, across the board. I mean, there's no comparison.
When you came back here, you started working with Seat and Graney, then you worked with Pritch, and things seemed to be going well with Mike. He's now in Denver. You're here still in Vegas, but on a different network now. What ultimately led you to the point, because you had been a Lotus guy for a long time.
Right.
What ultimately led you to say, it's time to leave Lotus, not to move out of state, but to work in the same market, but on a take a different challenge, which you're doing now with VSiN.
Yeah, so VSiN is the you know the first and only network dedicated to sports gambling. Pritch would be the first one to tell you, like, gambling's fascinating to me, but he just doesn't get it that much. I mean, you don't expect him to. He played in the NFL for a long time, and so he never worried about crunching numbers and laying 7 points in a game or anything like that. But I did from going back to 2003 until the time I took this job at VSiN, and you know, when I was in the Bay Area, that doesn't count either. But I did a Sunday morning show that was all gambling before the football game started, right? So for 13, 14 years in a row, I did it the first year at Lake Las Vegas, which is an awesome setup. Then I did it at the Hilton, now the Westgate, ever since. So I love the idea of just doing that gambling show. I mean, we're talking about 2 hours before kickoff, and why are the numbers changing? I bring on a sports book director, and the feedback that I got was awesome, right? So then Brian Musburger, who put this network together, he listened to that show online, and we always had Jimmy Vaccaro on from here at the South Point, and Jimmy and guys like Vinny said, look, if you're going to put together this network, you got to talk to Mitch, you got to talk to Paulie. They've been doing it for as long as anybody. And then when I sat down, or when we all sat down with Brian, like, I just, this idea to me, and the studios here, I mean, as you can see, I mean, they're fantastic. Yep. Right here in the sports book, they have the camera set up to go, so it would be a TV thing as well, and it's streaming online and everything like that. But just to pick Brian's brain, Brian Musburger, who is Brent's nephew, and to have his vision of this thing, and to, for me, how big sports gambling and that content can eventually become, I mean, if it gets legalized this year, the sky's the limit. I mean, going back to when I was doing that the pregame show, that to me is the pregame show that people want. Like, football fans, do they want former players just picking who's going to win between the Patriots and the Bills? I mean, the Patriots are laying 13.5. We know who's going to win the game. Football fans want to know who's going to cover. So that kind of stuff leading into a football game or college basketball or whatever the event is going to be, I think if, and I would say when, sports betting becomes legalized in this country, I think VSiN, it can get as big as ESPN was. Whoever thought ESPN was going to take off like it did? Nobody did. People laughed at ESPN, and look how big it became. But for a sports gambling network to be there and to be at the forefront of it, and if it does take off nationally, I think the sky's the limit.
In the past, the perception of sports gambling talk has always been the guy hawking a 1-800 number. Call me up. I'll tell you who's going to win. You got to pay me $500 just to get a pick. This is completely different. You guys are doing content.
Right.
You're talking about sports. You're obviously using the numbers to help inform the guy who's going to place the bet. What I'm curious, how do you do that in months like May? Like, okay, you're going to have the NBA playoffs, which definitely helped. Maybe sure. June's a better example because once the finals are over, you got that ghost town between the middle of June and August where – outside of free agency and trade deadline stuff, how do you talk for 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week about information and numbers? Are you still doing kind of what you were doing on a national show?
Pretty much. You are a fan of, and you always have been, of recycling content, right? So you're always going to have a new audience. So we're on the air from 7 to 10 Eastern. Let's say we talk about, from a gambling standpoint now, let's say we talk about there's an NBA Finals game and it's June 2nd, right? And we talk about the props for that game at 7:15. What's LeBron going to do tonight? His prop number is 27.5. Well, why should you bet it over? Why should you bet it under? We can absolutely hit that again at 8:45, or we can do 9:30 again, right? So we can recycle that kind of stuff. But football is still king. So in June and in July, at that point, like, season-long win totals are going to be out in college football and in the NFL. Well, there's going to be an angle there on June 3rd where we can talk about LeBron in the finals for an hour, whatever it is, an hour, 15 minutes, but we can also sprinkle in why the Cowboys over 8.5 is a good play. Maybe bring on a guest to talk about Dallas and how they're going to be this year. And then in the third hour, we can talk about the Steelers and why under 11.5 might be a good play, or we can hit a college team. So there's always going to be something that you can look ahead to as well. Maybe not that night's board of games. And the perfect example would be the week of the All-Star game in Major League Baseball. Like, that day, after the All-Star game, what is there now, a 2 or 3 day break where there are no games on the board?
Every station I worked at that week, I always did something different. I don't see the point in going to work, going, we'll just rely on the day's content.
Yeah, right.
There is
so
no
for
content.
Us, it's going to be, well, we don't have 9 baseball games to talk about from a gambling perspective. What are we going to do? Well, we got to talk about maybe 3 different football teams today in college and the NFL. Last year was a perfect example, and stuff always happens. Not that we're going to have another McGregor-Mayweather fight again. But, JB, that was one of my favorite gambling stories of all time, and that took place in late August. So that, I'm not going to say it carried us, but there was good content on that fight I think, almost every single day for 2 months leading up to the fight.
Yeah, because the way they built that drama, the passion, everybody got into that story. And you're right. It's all about – that's just like a football game. You know it's happening on the weekend. It's Monday through Friday. How do you keep telling the story to get to Saturday to watch for the payoff?
Right.
And that's kind of what made that fight great, is just you couldn't wait to see – all right, we've heard all this talk. We've seen all these angles. Now what does it mean?
And from a betting standpoint, so the odds, we never saw the true odds on that fight. Like Mayweather should have been minus $25 or whatever. It should have been a gigantic favorite, right? And McGregor should have been probably 15-1 on the take back at least, right? He had realistically no chance to win in the ring.
Yeah, it's a boxing fight. You're fighting a guy who never lost.
Exactly right. But odds makers will tell you, why put up the true odds when they could post McGregor at plus $5 or 5-1 when people are going to come to town and bet it anyway? People, they want to bet a little to win a lot. So the stories that came in last year on that fight, I mean, it was every single day. I mean, the ticket count, right? How many tickets they wrote on Mayweather to win compared to McGregor at the MGM properties in town. It was like 19,000 plus to McGregor to like 1,500 for Mayweather. Think about how lopsided that is. And then the Maloofs would come here and they wired $1 million or $880,000 or whatever to put on Mayweather. And Jimmy Vaccaro, who's the longtime odds maker, comes running over to me. Look at this. Here it is, $880,000. I take a picture of that. I tweet it out. And all of a sudden, that's in like extra mustard on SI. It takes off on all the blogs or whatever. The retweets and the likes for that were off the charts. It turned out to be, you know, people were so interested in that fight from a gambling standpoint that it was a gigantic story.
You mentioned before sports betting being legalized. How soon do you expect that to be the case?
A lot of people, like in this industry, I'll trust them because they know a lot more about it than I do. And I'll use David Purdom, for example, from ESPN. Does a great job covering gambling for ESPN Chalk. He actually has, I mean, to talk about a gambling from a gambling perspective here, he made legalized sports betting about a $2.50 favorite a couple of weeks ago or a month or so ago. Now he's dialed it back a little bit. But he still says that it's going to happen at some point this summer. And I would trust a guy like that. And I think a lot of people are in the same boat as David is, to where it's a favorite right now to pass. And I think New Jersey's going to win. NFL doesn't want it to win. And I think the people involved at the NFL are pretty confident it's not. But I think that people just have to open up their eyes and realize how much money is at stake here. Nevada does quite well legally with how much money they bring in. But it's nothing compared to what happens illegally across the country. It's like 1% or whatever it is. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket here in one state. If it happens to get, you know, legalized across the country, the numbers will blow your doors off.
You brought up about VSiN potentially, if it does get legalized, having the ability to maybe be for what ESPN's been to mainstream sports, VSiN becoming that to sports betting. When you guys are doing a show, you're on SiriusXM, you've got your video streams through the website. We're here in the South Point Casino. The studio is incredible. People are always dropping by to see it. Take me through your strategy from an on-air standpoint. Calls, guests, social interactions. How you guys weave that in and how you determine, because Sirius, there is no ratings. Is it the $880,000 bet that determines we're on the right track? Or is it that, hey, we had 500 interactions on this topic on Twitter, which doesn't mean they necessarily listen to you on the air. They may have just seen your tweet. So how do you determine whether or not you're on the right track or on the wrong track?
It's a great question again. We've gotten positive feedback from Sirius quite a bit. And again, I don't understand how they can't track the ratings. That to me is just, they worry about how many people actually sign up for the service. And now it's like 40 million or whatever it is. But I mean, so that's a little bizarre to me. But we don't take phone calls. That's not even an option. So we, you know, Twitter's a big thing, obviously, for us. But also we have the app that you can get on your phone. And you can also watch on the website. So I think here internally, for the guys that are, you know, part of the management team here at VSiN, they can track numbers on the website and also the VSiN app, which you can just watch the show again on the phone or your tablet or whatever. And they can have, that's a pretty good fallback from what I understand, to see how many people are clicking in at a certain time. And
which is foreign for you, because for 15 years, you've been living and dying on a monthly book, you know, hearing people, you know, watching people go out to party or people, you know, contemplate calling it a day and going home and quitting the business because they just can't seem to get the pop on the numbers.
Yep.
I went through that when I worked at ESPN. I spent 2 years there, and you can have five local affiliates who you're killing it with and five who you're getting crushed by. And you go, well, which one matters? You know, it's hard.
Yep.
So, like, from a talent standpoint, like, when you go into a show and you're working with Paulie and you're trying to get a feel of, are we on the right track doing this? Is this pleasing the bosses and the fan base, or are we just doing stuff that feels naturally right and we'll just let it go where it goes?
Paulie and I have worked together for so long. I think we have our chemistry goes back a long ways, and it's a natural chemistry. He's a Midwest guy. I'm a Midwest guy. So we get along on and off the show. So I think we have a general idea of what's going to hit. But also, you know, gambling can be so hardcore. So I'll go back to college basketball, for example. If we're going to break down games and talk about whether or not, you know, 3.5 is the right number and the total is 121, if that makes sense, how many games do we do that with? Like, so if you want to try to play the hits with gambling, are we going to talk about IUPUI and whomever they're playing that night? Do we talk about Ryder and Hofstra playing on a Tuesday? Like, that's for the really hardcore, I think, listeners, right, to get involved in a game like that. So do we do that, or do we stick with, like, the teams that are in the top 25? So I think there's a balance right there. And also just, you know, so we try to play the hits, but also do it from a gambling perspective where we're actually breaking down games or future numbers or whatever it is.
So when you see groups like Churning Group go in with the Action Network, you see Fox Sports Radio starting to do some things. Is it good for the business that there's more sports betting content, or would you like them to not be in it so that way you guys just own the whole pie?
So we're the only ones? Well, that'd be great to have a monopoly on it, right? No, I think it's a good thing, though, right? I mean, yeah. So where it's coming to the forefront, and who knows, maybe like this push with Action Network and Fox and all of us together, maybe that will be one of the reasons why, in the end, it could be a catalyst to, who knows, it's going to win people over and say, we got to legalize it. I mean, that's far-fetched, I think a lot of people would say. But as I think the more the merrier. Absolutely, I'm on board.
VEASAN, since you came here and where it is now, what's your takeaways on the way the network has grown, and where do you see it growing in the next 2 to 3 years?
Again, I'll cross my fingers. In the short term, hopefully this year, maybe we're on like some sort of a device that's beyond like where we're at right now, right? Maybe eventually we're going to be on so you can just sit at home and click on your streaming device, whatever it is, and oop, there's VEASAN right now. And I can watch the show right there, and I can take it in that way. Maybe that's around the corner. Again, this is me speculating. I hope if Brian or Bill, if you're listening, don't get mad at me, but maybe we can connect with a dish service at some point. And maybe we're on DirecTV, or maybe we're on Dish Network, something like that. That'd be absolutely humongous.
But when you came here, you took a leap of faith.
Oh, I totally did.
Since taking that leap of faith, how do you feel about making that jump?
Well, we were doing a two-hour show, and since then, they like ripped up that contract and said, let's move you to mornings and make it a longer contract for 3 hours a day. So that was a pretty good feeling. And when you have, you know, guys telling you that, let's hope this contract doesn't go for the entire time, let's hope we rip up this one again soon and start over again from scratch and make it a longer one, that's a pretty good feeling to have. Like, they're that confident. And I just think that overall, when the handle goes up on the Super Bowl, right, the betting handle in the state goes up like $20 million and March Madness goes up and you see what Las Vegas is like on a big betting weekend and you can't get a room here and people are, it's standing room only at the sportsbook for certain events, things are going pretty well.
So when you said they ripped up the contract and they put you into mornings, did they tell you that that meant that you would be getting up at 2 o'clock
no,
in the morning?
No, I thought it was going to be like a typical morning show. This 4 to 7 nonsense, Jesus, we need to talk about that again.
The VEASAN Morning Show airs 7 to 10 Eastern Time for those listening, but Mitch actually works 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. We're actually in a casino right now at 8:30 in the morning doing this interview, so it's definitely a life adjustment, I'm sure. I mean, do you even watch a game to its conclusion?
I do, and I try to tape a lot of stuff. I got to catch at least, you know, some Sports Center or something before I come in, unless I can flip my schedule where I sleep during the day, which has been impossible. This is going a little inside, but I mean, so where I could stay up all night long, then I would be able to get everything done. But I try to stay up and watch the East Coast games right away at 4 o'clock, as much as the West Coast as I possibly can, and I try to take a nap during the day when I get home.
I'm going to wrap with this. I do a thing with every guest called Quick Hits. I hit them with a couple of different topics. First thought that pops to your mind. Las Vegas getting another pro franchise. Which sport puts it in first?
NBA, within 10 years.
The year where sports betting is legalized across the country.
2018. Fingers are crossed. Let's go, huh? 2018. Let's hope so.
Best piece of advice you've received during your career?
I'm going to screw this up, but it goes back to when I first started. It goes back to Mike Sullivan. And John Hansen would hit me over the head with a 2x4 right now because I guarantee he remembers it. But it's like, your show tomorrow is the most important show that you're ever going to do. Or the game that you're calling that night is the most important game that you're ever going to call. That's what it is. You could call play-by-play for any game on a Wednesday night, and you could think that you absolutely were an A-plus and hit it out of the park, right? Or you could do a show. And at the end of the show, you could high-five each other and say, best show we've ever done. What does that mean tomorrow?
And then finally, for those who are thinking about going into the business, if they were thinking about getting into sports betting content, what's one suggestion you would give them to pursue a path down this road?
I would say make sure that you know the lingo. There's a language here. There's a gambling language that goes to it. And so, you know, I've seen people that think they're part of the business, and I'm not like, I'm not Jimmy Vaccaro, right? I haven't been around this racket for 40 years, but I've been in Las Vegas for 2001, so I think I kind of get it. So for the people that are up and coming and they might be on somewhere right now where it is sports betting, know what you're talking about. And don't say something because you think it's cute when you're in fact going to be wrong. Because I've seen that where people will throw out like a betting saying, right? A betting phrase, and they got it wrong. And you work in sports betting, get it right.
So what's it like being Brent Musburger's teammate?
Pretty awesome. I mean, you were out here on draft day last year.
The NFL draft, right.
Maybe the highlight of my career.
Yeah, you were working with them.
That was my first week being full-time here at VSiN. And so that Thursday night's the draft, and they're like, we want you to be on the coverage with Brent. I'm like, wow, okay. So Brent was the anchor, and then he's going to Jimmy Vaccaro and me to get, like, analysis on the draft from a betting perspective. And then the Bears trade up and take Trubisky, and all hell broke loose. And I'm like, I'm on the air with Brent Musburger the first week of this stuff. I'm like, it doesn't get any better than this.
He's fantastic to listen to. Always has been. But even now, hearing him and being able to give some opinions and then seeing how he pokes the bear on Twitter sometimes, very entertaining. Hey, man, good to see you. Congratulations on everything. I'm looking forward to seeing how this develops as we move forward.
Thanks so much, man. Good to see you again.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was Mitch Moss of VSiN. I hope you guys enjoyed that. You know, the sports betting content space is one that I expect to grow, and I think the Musburgers got in it at the right time. One comment that especially stuck with me from our conversation was when Mitch said he thinks VSiN has the potential to be as big as ESPN. Now, some of you are going to say that's overly positive thinking, and I don't blame you for thinking that. But his overall point was that ESPN originally wasn't expected to become the juggernaut that it became. And if you look at the revenue projections being kicked around for sports betting, should it become legalized, it does make you wonder, how big can this thing be? That's going to be a fascinating sports media story to follow in the near future. There are many other layers to the conversation as well that I found interesting. Hopefully you guys found a few as well to pique your curiosity. But that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to each and every one of you for spending your time listening. I'm hoping to have a new episode available every Wednesday this season, but I'm on the road the next 3 weeks, so if in-market work puts me behind a day or two, I'll update you guys on social media. On that note, I am available for in-market projects and ongoing station support. I'm fortunate to work with some successful brands and individuals, but I'm always looking to expand my reach and help others. If you're interested in helping your company, brands, and people, feel free to reach out. My contact information is on sportsradiopd.com. One thing I would love your feedback on when you have some time, let me know who you guys want to hear on future episodes. I've got a few wheels in motion already, but if there are certain people who you'd like to see appear on a future podcast, let me know and I'll see if I can make it happen. As I mentioned on the season 3 premiere, I'll be closing things out this season with a different quote to end each episode. This week's message, life is a series of decisions. The next one you make could shape the legacy you leave behind. So choose wisely. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.